Jerome K. Jerome. From the Diary of Pilgrimage, 1891. From Evergreens. Bulldogs. What a splendid old dog he is! So grim, so silent, so staunch. So terrible when he has got his idea of his duty clear before him. So absurdly meek when it is only himself that is concerned. He is the gentlest, too, and the most lovable of all dogs. He does not look it. The sweetness of his disposition would not strike the casual observer at first glance. He resembles the gentleman spoken of in the oft-quoted stanza, "He's all right when you're nosing, but you've got to know him first." The first time I ever met a bulldog, to speak to, that is, was many years ago. We were lodging down in the country, an orphan friend of mine named George and myself. And one night, coming home late from some dissolving views, we found the family had gone to bed. They had left a light in our room, however, and we went in and sat down and began to take off our boots. And then, for the first time, we noticed on the hearthrug a bulldog. A dog with a more thoughtfully ferocious expression. A dog with, apparently, a heart more dead to all ennobling and civilizing sentiments I have never seen. As George said, he looked more like some heathen idol than a happy English dog. He appeared to have been waiting for us, and he rose up and greeted us with a ghastly grin and got between us and the door. We smiled at him, a sickly propitiatory smile. We said, "Good dog, poor fellow," and we asked him, in tones implying that the question could admit of no negative, if he was not a nice old chap. We did not really think so. We had our own private opinion concerning him, and it was unfavourable. But we did not express it. We would not have hurt his feelings for the world. He was a visitor, our guest, so to speak, and, as well-brought-up young men, we felt that the right thing to do was for us to prevent his gaining any hint that we were not glad to see him, and to make him feel as little as possible the awkwardness of his position. I think we succeeded. He was singularly unembarrassed, and far more at his ease than even we were. He took but little notice of our flattering remarks, but was much drawn towards George's legs. George used to be, I remember, rather proud of his legs. I could never see enough in them, myself, to excuse George's vanity. Indeed, they always struck me as lumpy. It is only fair to acknowledge, however, that they quite fascinated that bulldog. He walked over and criticised them with the air of a long-baffled connoisseur who had at last found his ideal. At the termination of his inspection, he distinctly smiled. George, who at that time was modest and bashful, blushed and drew them up onto the chair. On the dog's displaying a desire to follow them, George moved up onto the table and squatted there in the middle, nursing his knees. George's legs being lost to him, the dog appeared inclined to console himself with mine. I went and sat beside George on the table. Sitting with your feet drawn up in front of you on a small and rickety one-legged table is a most trying exercise, especially if you're not used to it. George and I both felt our position keenly. We did not like to call out for help and bring the family down. We were proud young men, and we feared lest, to the unsympathetic eye of the comparative stranger, the spectacle we should present might not prove imposing. So we sat on in silence for about half an hour, the dog keeping a reproachful eye upon us from the nearest chair and displaying elephantine delight whenever we made any movement suggestive of climbing down. At the end of the half hour, we discussed the advisability of chancing it, but decided not to. "We should never," George said, "confound foolhardiness with courage." "Courage," he continued. George had quite a gift for maxims. "Courage is the wisdom of manhood. Foolhardiness, the folly of youth." He said that to get down from the table while that dog remained in the room would clearly prove us to be possessed of the latter quality. So we restrained ourselves and sat on. We sat on for over an hour, by which time, having both grown careless of life and indifferent to the voice of wisdom, we did chance it, and throwing the tablecloth over our would-be murderer, charged for the door and got out. The next morning, we complained to our landlady of her carelessness in leaving wild beasts about the place, and we gave her a brief, if not exactly truthful, history of the business. Instead of the tender, womanly sympathy we had expected, the old lady sat down in the easy chair and burst out laughing. "What, old Boozer!" she exclaimed. "You was afraid of old Boozer? Why, bless you, he wouldn't hurt a worm. He ain't got a tooth in his head, he ain't. We has to feed him with a spoon. And I'm sure the way the cat chivies him about must be enough to make his life a burden to him. I expect he wanted you to nurse him. He's used to being nursed." And that was the brute that had kept us sitting on a table with our boots off for over an hour on a chilly night. Another bulldog exhibition that occurs to me was one given by my uncle. He had had a bulldog, a young one, given to him by a friend. It was a grand dog, so his friend had told him. All it wanted was training. It had not been properly trained. My uncle did not profess to know much about the training of bulldogs, but it seemed a simple enough matter, so he thanked the man and took his prize home at the end of a rope. "Have we got to live in the house with this?" asked my aunt, indignantly, coming into the room about an hour after the dog's advent, followed by the quadruped himself, wearing an idiotically self-satisfied air. "That!" exclaimed my uncle in astonishment. "Why, it's a splendid dog! His father was honourably mentioned only last year at the aquarium." "Ah, well, all I can say is that his son isn't going the way to get honourably mentioned in this neighbourhood," replied my aunt with bitterness. "He's just finished killing poor Mrs. McSlanger's cat, if you want to know what he's been doing. And a pretty row there'll be about it, too."
"Can't we hush it up?" said my uncle.
"Hush it up," retorted my aunt. "If you'd heard the row, you wouldn't sit there and talk like a fool." "And if you'll take my advice," added my aunt, "you'll set to work on this training, or whatever it is, that has got to be done to the dog before any human life is lost." My uncle was too busy to devote any time to the dog for the next day or so, and all that could be done was to keep the animal carefully confined to the house. And a nice time we had with him. It was not that the animal was bad-hearted. He meant well. He tried to do his duty. What was wrong with him was that he was too hard-working. He wanted to do too much. He started with an exaggerated and totally erroneous notion of his duties and responsibilities. His idea was that he had been brought into the house for the purpose of preventing any living human soul from coming near it, and of preventing any person who might by chance have managed to slip in from ever again leaving it. We endeavoured to induce him to take a less exalted view of his position, but in vain. That was the conception he had formed in his own mind concerning his earthly task, and that conception he insisted on living up to with what appeared to us to be unnecessary conscientiousness.
He so effectually frightened away all the tradespeople that they at last refused to even enter the gate. All that they would do was to bring their goods and drop them over the fence into the front garden, from where we had to go and fetch them as we wanted them. "I wish you'd run into the garden," my aunt would say to me. I was stopping with them at the time. "And see if you can find any sugar. I think there's some under the big rose bush. If not, you'd better go to Jones's and order some." And on the cook's inquiring what she should get ready for lunch, my aunt would say, "Well, I'm sure, Jane, I hardly know. What have we? Are there any chops in the garden? Or was it a bit of steak that I noticed on the lawn?" On the second afternoon, the plumbers came to do a little job to the kitchen boiler. The dog, being engaged at the time in the front of the house, driving away the postman, did not notice their arrival. He was broken-hearted at finding them there when he got downstairs, and evidently blamed himself most bitterly. Still, there they were, all owing to his carelessness, and the only thing to be done now was to see that they did not escape. There were three plumbers. It always takes three plumbers to do a job. The first man comes on ahead to tell you that the second man will be there soon. The second man comes to say that he can't stop. And the third man follows to ask if the first man has been there. And that faithful, dumb animal kept them pinned up in the kitchen. Fancy wanting to keep plumbers in a house longer than is absolutely necessary. For 5 hours, until my uncle came home. And the bill ran, "Self and two men engaged 6 hours, repairing boiler tap, 18 shillings, materials, tuppence. Total, 18 shillings and tuppence. He took a dislike to the cook from the very first. We did not blame him for this. She was a disagreeable old woman, and we did not think much of her ourselves. But when it came to keeping her out of the kitchen, so that she could not do her work, and my aunt and uncle had to cook the dinner themselves, assisted by the housemaid, a willing enough girl but necessarily inexperienced, we felt that the woman was being subjected to persecution. My uncle, after this, decided that the dog's training must be no longer neglected. The man next door but one always talked as if he knew a lot about sporting matters, and to him my uncle went for advice as to how to set about it. "Oh, yes," said the man cheerfully. "Very simple thing, training a bulldog. Wants patience, that's all." "Oh, that will be all right," said my uncle. "It can't want much more than living in the same house with him before he's trained us. How do you start?" "Well, I'll tell you," said the next door but one man. "You take him up into a room where there's not much furniture, and you shut the door and bolt it." "I see," said my uncle. "Then you place him on the floor in the middle of the room, and you go down on your knees in front of him and begin to irritate him."
"Oh?"
"Yes, and you go on irritating him until you've made him quite savage." "Which, from what I know of the dog, won't take long," observed my uncle thoughtfully. "So much the better. The moment he gets savage, he will fly at you." My uncle agreed that the idea seemed plausible. "He will fly at your throat," continued the next door but one man, "and this is where you will have to be careful. As he springs towards you, and before he gets hold of you, you must hit him a fair straight blow on his nose and knock him down."
"Yes, I see what you mean."
"Quite so. Well, the moment you have knocked him down, he will jump up and go for you again. You must knock him down again, and you must keep on doing this until the dog is thoroughly cowed and exhausted.